问题是跟那个问题交对，就是哪一天你会离出去，还是怎样？是 Get married just in New Jersey 吗？
Get married in New Jersey。
嗯
哼。 But I would say from my experience that women who are not extremely active, not joining the Socialist Party, run up the mill Socialist Party members, women were just as, it was usually a man and wife.
Mm-hmm. You mean single women wouldn't be active?
Oh, they might be.
Mm-hmm.
But your typical socialist man, it would be the man and wife were
mm-hmm.
And then the children at least amount of families had the young people's social state, which was very, very nice. It was social, it was political.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a club. And
would that be for little children or sort of teenagers?
Young people.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers and young people in their early 20s. But as a child, for example, I used very often to they called them Yipsel.
Mm-hmm.
Yipsel picnics. They had bowling clubs, and in the summer they would do. It was very nice to be social. At least this was good.
Mm-hmm.
They could get out of it. And it was a very warm, clannish sort of thing. And I would say, by and large, that a good many women who were socialists,
mm-hmm.
as well as their husband. And I do believe that except in Milwaukee, that the Socialist Party did it. Certainly believe in
it. Well, it certainly supported it on the platform
yes.
and everything. I was just, you know, the way that people act in meetings and the dynamics of local groups are often quite different from a national stand. I just wondered if you had noticed anything.
Well, my experience with women was that in the Socialist Party was that by and large they took a very active part throughout the Midwest and the South.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had encampments, when they had political speakers there, it was a sort of a combined effort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the women would cook the food, husking the idea.
Uh-huh.
And I think it meant a great deal for them socially. They were at home with their friends.
It was a sort of frontier thing.
Yes.
Tell me more about the encampments. Like, what were they like?
Well, they were huge. I think some of the most successful of them must have had, what was for that time, tremendous crowds.
That's a lot. I mean, they must have come from the whole wide area.
They came, in some cases, without, few of them had cars, practically none of them had cars, in spring wagons. And sometimes they would travel a distance of 40, 50, 60 miles.
Could they make that in a day? Or would that
would have to tell. Of course, some of them came. And they would come in a couple of wagons. And the food, and simply, in fact, that was what they had. And they would have usually more than one speaker. And then they would, how they did it, I'll never know. A socialist encampment, they encamped in the summer, which was the only time the Prime Minister came to see, because they'd leave and they would take care of their stock at them. But harvest was in, and it was not time to cultivate. It had to be in summer, and without air conditioning,
must have been hot.
Right out on the baby plains. And they were very moving things because it was the pioneer spirit. It's surprising that people, they must have had very little education, very little.
They were all farmers, they weren't city people mixed in.
The encampments were the farmers.
They would be in areas where there weren't any cities.
The city people were another kettle of fish altogether.
Yeah.
But that it is amazing that of these farmers who worked in those days on the mutual mechanization of farming, was a man killing and especially a woman killing proposition. That they had the energy to even think about how that was invested in the
so they must have been starved for something outside of work.
Yes, I know, but when you're tired, it's
not
that. And also, since they would be the exception in the community, it took a lot of investment for them to be socialists.
Right, they must have really been considered freaks.
Well, of course, when you're in an army community, you're judged on many bases. Are you a Christian?
Yeah.
Do you take care of your stock? Do you help your neighbor out? In other words, are you a good citizen?
Right, so it doesn't matter so much if you have a few odd ideas next to
it. Yes, I mean, in those days and in that part of the country, since each neighbor was more or less dependent on, they were so dependent on each other. That even a thing like childbirth, for example, when your wife was going to have a child, if your anyone was going to have her, it would be a neighbor woman.
Right.
So they were dependent, they were also dependent on each other. And as much as farm work doesn't wait on illness or accident. So if something happens to the farm or to his machinery, he absolutely must be helped by his neighbor, and he in turn must help. So in that way, being mutually dependent, I think probably they may have been more tolerant than your blue collar worker who can afford to be at odds with his neighbor.
Yeah. Where did the encampments take place? I know there was one in Kansas. So there was
Oklahoma,
one
in Kansas.
Were those states by then, or were they still territory?
Oklahoma was partly a state.
Uh-huh.
And then it became entirely a state in 1960. I was born in Indian Territory.
Yeah.
The northeastern section was still in Indian Territory.
I remember reading an article by your mother, I can't remember where now, about the Indians and how people were totally grafting off of the Indians and how terrible it was. I wondered if the social, I mean, that's the only thing I read that came out of Socialist Party that even recognized that Indians existed.
As a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because my father went on one of these encampments, and there were Indians talking to
me. Oh, how nice. Yeah.
It was down in Cherokee Country. It was in the part of the country where I was more attached to the Cherokees are.
Well, there was a reservation.
There had been a reservation by that time. It was no longer. There still were reservations, but the Indians had land, and they were ranchers, farmers, or what have you. Very bad land, by the way. It was terrible.
Well, I'm sure they gave them the worst land they wanted.
Yes, it had oil on it, but they didn't know that. Later. And he was a great amateur photographer, a very good one, by the way. And he took any number of pictures of Indians still in the dress with the papooses on their back. Beautiful kinds of things. So there were Indians who were there.
Oh, that's great. I wonder what they thought of.
But I think I may have told you that the reason my grandfather owned land out in this part of Oklahoma, he went broke in the drought. And then he wanted a small ranch. So he knew this section, and he knew that he could run the kind of a ranch farm that would be within his capacity. His children by this time were pretty well along.
This was your mother's father?
My mother's father.
Yeah.
And of course he knew that within a short period of time, this was maybe 1992, that Oklahoma would become a state. So he scouted around and found a piece of land that had a good spring on it and had the other topographical features that were necessary to run a ranch. And it was part of the allotment of an Indian. Of course, it could not be sold legally because the Indians couldn't sell an allotment. But he paid for it. And he moved in and he put up his house. And when the Oklahoma became the state, the Indian brought him.
When it became a state, then the Indians
would
sell to him. I see.
You see, actually, my grandfather had already paid for it and built his house and was living on it. But he had no title.
But he had a good relationship with the Indians. So.
Well, he said that his experience with the Indians was treated fairly with them. They would always keep their word absolutely faithful. That even if this Indian had grown children, for example, if he had happened to die, his son would have been, because this was a
Mm-hmm.
And we had no neighbors who were not able
to belong to this. This was not in St. Louis.
No, this was in Oklahoma.
Oh, you were born on that farm?
I was born in Oklahoma. I was born on my grandfather's ranch. Right in Indian Territory at that time.
How come your mother was there? I thought...
Well, she came home to have me.
Oh, I see.
She and my father, Dick, was born.
Uh-huh.
And they had a house someplace or other. But their mother, by this time, you see, was just simply dumped Dick. And my grandfather took care of her.
Oh, your other grandmother.
Her mother.
Right. Oh.
In her home.
Uh-huh.
So, mother came home and left it with my grandmother. He was leaving at that time. And then 2.5 years later, I would say a few months only before I was born, because she went back and working as long as it was possible and decent. And then she came back to Bonita.
And Dick was there for 2.5 years without seeing your parents?
Oh, no, they came back.
Uh-huh. But he essentially lived there. Yeah.
But when my parents went on trips or whatever, he stayed with my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born. And my parents both went on various Sunday expeditions. It was before they started working for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you live there all the time or just when they were on the road?
I lived there all the time.
Uh-huh.
I lived there all the time until I was about 2.5 years old.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to Kansas City.
That's when I started the Ripso, or?
No. We moved to Kansas City, and my father, as a matter of fact, was working for an electrical firm. He's an engineer. But additionally, he was active in the Socialist Party. My mother was lecturing all over the place. And then he made this contact with Phil Wagner, who owned the Ripso.
Mm-hmm.
And then the family moved to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
But until I was 2.5, 3 years old, I stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents would travel back and forth. Of course, this was one thing my father objected to.
Yeah.
In the first place, he was an urban person. He never took kindly to country life. The idea was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't learn at the age of 26 to learn to judge.
Yeah.
And he also felt that, after all, he had a wife and he had children. And he didn't like the idea of the children being left with my grandparents. So he was able to establish a home. He wanted a home.
Mm-hmm.
To go to visit my grandparents was quite another matter.
Yeah.
But he wanted his own home. So it was then that we moved to Kansas City. And then my grandfather sold this ranch. He was badly injured in the Civil War, and apparently it finally caught up with him.
Mm-hmm.
So he sold it and he stayed with us for a while in Kansas City. And then when they decided that they wanted to go to Fort Dodge, my aunt had to make sure that he was at home. And from that time on, my grandparents would, as long as they were able, as long as my grandfather was well enough, so they could live. He could live alone until my grandmother. They lived in Fort Dodge, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
In the old soldier's home there, he was the officer of the commissary or something.
You mean they both lived there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was very nice. They had a whole bunch of houses. It had been a fort.
So it was also little detached houses, maybe?
All the detached houses.
That's nice.
And the setup was extremely nice because Kansas was extremely generous to her.
Mm-hmm.
They got a very nice pension.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, had some money anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But the children could come and stay with them, and they just had their nice little house. And it wasn't anything elegant, but very adequate.
Mm-hmm.
Of what you would need in the state of Kansas. I mean, it had, I think, even indoor plumbing and water kind of thing.
That's pretty good.
It was like a small town, except that they were all old soldiers, and of course they could get together and talk about the war.
That was pretty exciting.
I loved it. They loved it. And they had lots of land and gardens. They had chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the commissary where things were issued, all of the necessities, whatever them may be.
So after they went to, how long did they stay in St. Louis? They stayed until after they stood up, I guess.
My parents?
Yeah.
No. We lived in St. Louis from the time I was 4 until I was 10. And then my mother by this time had fallen in with an accident.
That was 1917? Or?
Yeah, I was earlier than that. It was 1960.
She was arrested then?
And the National Red Cross self-publication.
Yeah.
My parents went to Florida. There was a small college down there, one of these colleges.
And it's Ruskin College?
Yeah. We had a house down there.
And then you had owned it all along, or you just got it there?
As a matter of fact, we rented it, unfortunately. We never owned it. Mm. We could easily have, but we didn't. At any rate, they were interested in this college, and my father was teaching mathematics and so forth. On the faculty. And it was in a very beautiful rural part of Florida, completely disassociated from the nearby town.
It was all socialist, right? Or no?
Mostly socialist.
Yeah.
And we were down there for really only about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, my mother was going on her merry way lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
And her appeal, of course, was pending at that time. Her appeal was rejected.
Yeah.
But there was an interval of, but she never had it. She appealed for a new trial, but she couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an interim there. And then we went back to St. Louis. Not, the family was temporarily scattered when I thought I was in Memphis, Tennessee. This is very dear events of ours.
Who was the leader?
The Simons.
Maywood and Algie?
Hmm?
Maywood and Algie Simons? Or, no, they were in Wisconsin.
No, they were no one well known.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They were very nice business people who happened to be socialists.
Mm-hmm.
Very good friends of ours, and those children all were known. So I went to the Simons to stay there for the school year.
Uh-huh.
My brothers were with an uncle.
That was at the same time you were in New York, the same year?
I went to New York after that.
Uh-huh.
While the appeal was pending, I went to New York when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
Then the family all got together in St. Louis, got an apartment, and established their home. But in the meantime, of course, my mother was still lecturing all the time. They didn't suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And getting, of course, my stage managed by my father, who wrote her speeches for her.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fund called the Kate Richards O'Hare Defense Fund. And of course, this was back then. I must say that while there was disharmony between the Eastern and the Western group, nevertheless, officially, she was supported by the Eastern group, and they raised the money for the appeal and for the various charges, which had to be extremely expensive to her. So I was with Mother on this last trip, when she had already been tried and sentenced. But I think her appeal still was pending. And then we went back to St. Louis, and she went to prison. My father was in St. Louis with the boys, and had a housekeeper, I think.
What was he doing during that time?
He was still trying to put another thing.
And was that, it was full-time defense work?
Or? It was full-time, what was he doing? Outside of trying to get out of prison. I think he probably went back to work for the MS movement or something.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, I was in spent the summer in New York, and then I went back. And then, of course, my father would just have this
morning.
Because prison was a grim thing.
Yeah.
It was a frightful thing. And he always said, my he said, if your mother had only missed me, she would not have had to retract one word, and she never would have gone to prison.
I don't know what
it was that she said, but he said in one of her speeches, instead of following the script, she added fuel to the flame and made me wish it.
And she wanted to be made a case.
Well, she didn't want to go to prison, but she thought she could put it over.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't think that this was the straw that broke the camel's back, because actually she had become an embarrassment. And I think that in all probability the war by this time was over. And here she was, an exemplary mother, so far as the world knew,
yeah.
You know, a woman of character who had immensely powerful friends, of course.
Yeah, they, there was no reason they would want to put her in jail.
Well, I think they probably, if they could have avoided it,
yeah.
And saved face, she would never have gone to prison, mainly because she was a woman and had a family,
yeah.
Because it was too bad. But whatever it was, I wish I knew what it was, but my father said after I was grown, he said, you know, your mother never would have gone to prison. But she could be so stubborn, and also sometimes so impulsive. She did not always think that this is not the time or the place to say this.
Whatever it is, it must be in the record of the trial somewhere. I've never seen
it. No, it was something she said during the time that her appeal was pending.
Oh, so it would just have been in the judgment of the appeal or whatever, so probably...
Either that, or actually, I suppose you know what the circumstances of her arrest were.
I don't know if I do.
It had nothing to do with it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The socialism of that.
What was it?
Out in Montana, there was a postmistress who had been appointed by someone who apparently must have been liberal, but she was such a
person. What was her name?
I don't remember what her name was. She was nobody.
Mm-hmm.
By nobody, I mean she was just a socialist.
Yeah.
And the postmistress in a small town, a politician in that small town, wanted her ousted
so that he could make
his own appointment. And what was the basis of her being ousted? She had been seen at a speech given by the notorious Kate Richards O'Hare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was the little thing that started the ball rolling. In order to displace the postmistress, you can go and listen to a speech.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person who was making the speech has a right to make the speech and is not doing anything illegal, this is not going to stick. So in order to displace this postmistress, mother was arrested for criminal syndicalism.
Oh, good God.
And the quotation was outrageous. Whatever she was, she was a thoroughly well-bred person. And mother, of course, they had no tape recorders in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And in a small town where the courts were, well, even if they had wanted to be fair, I think maybe they couldn't have been fair because they were all capable of money. In any event, what she said, she said, and I think that's what she said, was that she, Mrs. Anderson, she didn't believe in war, but it seemed that we were going to be in war, and she would say to her young man that she did not believe in war, and if he went, he would be, his blood might enrich the soil of France for a war which basically was none of our concern,
mm-hmm.
and not necessary to our existence anymore. But if this was what, where he felt his duty lay, then she would say, go and God bless you.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that my husband or my son would produce it,
mm-hmm.
which of course was, and what she was accused of having said, was that anyone who volunteered for the army was only fit for cannon fodder and fertilizer.
Yeah, that doesn't sound likely, does it?
Which is an extremely vulgar statement. Well, all of the, when she was tried, all of the witnesses that she had, and she was trying to get on her,
mm-hmm.
and travel 30 and 40 miles through the snow and the old rattle the words to testify. Their testimony was different because there were two or three witnesses that were lying in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know my mother could be very indiscreet. I mean, if she got carried away, but this was not her style.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a speech that she could play for money. Even though they don't speak the notes, they speak the same speech.
You know, they never ask.
But she always changed the little notes. She meant, well, this is not her style. She didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
Actually. So the whole thing, as I say, arose out of this small, heavy desire to fire a postmistress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure that she was a socialist. she may just have gone to the center and was seen there.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of that, they were trying to discharge her and show that she was disloyal or she was being there. That's it.
Yes. But and on the appeal, she would have appealed to people outside of Montana when it was going up to...
Yes, but remember at the time, was
yeah.
We didn't have the kind of court system that we have now.
Yeah, so great still, now either.
Well, I think there still is a lot of corruption and there's still a lot of stupidity. But on the other hand, I would say this, that if you were poor, you wouldn't have a chance now unless you had some powerful organization on your side. But she certainly had plenty of money for her legal defense.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if it had been today, she would never in the right world have been convicted in the first place, not her second.
Well, I mean, that the law, she couldn't have been even brought to trial for saying.
No, of course not. Criminals anyway.
Could be any day, though.
I don't think so.
Mm. Hope not.
But she was there 14 months. I would say she behaved magnificently and made the best of it and managed to get the whole prison on the theater. She had the Catholic chaplain smuggling letters out to my father, but then we wrote letters that went out when we went to the center, you know.
Oh. You know, those ones that were mimeographed up?
Mm-hmm. There were the ones that were censored. They used to come in. She had to write single space on the back letter one side only.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come in with whole lines of the block out of the cutout. But then there would be other letters which would... She never spoke of it, I mean, except the family. Nobody was the one who did the best for the Catholic chaplain.
Did Emma Golden get letters out? I don't remember ever seeing
them. I'm sure she did. Yeah. Well, but there was, see, there was no one to blame
her. Yeah, she didn't have any organization.
And I would suspect that Emma, being the kind of person she was, no politician at all.
Mm.
Would never know how to manipulate things.
Yeah.
And she would be very uncooperative. It was a question of saying what she felt or keeping her mouth shut. She'd say what she felt.
Yeah. You know, her autobiography is out in paperback now.
I read it from her first day now.
Yeah, I think it's lots of fun.
But as a matter of fact, my mother was extremely fond of Emma Goldman.
Uh-huh.
They were very good companions. Emma was the sort of person who could absolutely be curious about things. Mother said she would quiver her head to the court. She
said
But she was absolutely wonderful to the girls, and it was a very fortunate thing for the two of them that they were there together, because, of course, there was no other intellectual companionship for either one of them. And so it was really great. I think Mother got there first.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And she had started reorganizing the place. And then when Emma, I think as a matter of fact, they let them have stalls right next to each other and let them have food in their cells, which had never been done before. And I remember that there were parcels going in there all the time. There was always this propaganda to send. And this was Colgate, the Colgate Soap Company. He's one of my mother's friends. And she used to send cartons.
At the letters that I read all seem to be about food and about passing up and down the line. How did he like you?
Food and toilet articles. And I'll tell you another person who contributed to the prison fund, this is for the people who were in prison. I don't know if you remember Ovington's American.
Mary White Ovington was the same.
She was also one who sent money to the prison.
Your mother stayed interested in prison reform after that.
She was immensely interested in prison reform from many points of view. As a matter of fact, after she got out of prison, we went out to Kansas and revived the Ripsaw with Emmanuel Holden Julius, who was married to Marcette Holden, who was Jane Addams' niece, the daughter of her sister. And this was out in Kansas, this was a small town. He had a small publishing firm, so he did something quite remarkable. In addition to the, I think it was the Appeal to Reason, but the two big papers were the Appeal to Reason and the National Whip Law. So they consolidated this. My father edited the Holden Julius, of course, was a socialist and a radical and that sort of thing, also a big one. So they had the Appeal to Reason and Whip Law, they consolidated, but my father said it. Emmanuel Holden and Julius put out books for 5 cents called The Little Blue Books.
I don't think I've ever seen those.
Did you know that it was he who published the story of mankind first? In the Little Blue Book. He broken up into sections or chapters. But he was the first one, and he had a very bright idea there, to provide some of it was trashy, but most of it was not. He was the first one to bring out worldwide writers, modern and classic. For 5 cents. And they were little pamphlets. They were little books, not so big. The print was good. No, he started them at 25 cents because that's what it cost to turn them out. When my father got into it, of course, he was a very fine efficiency. In those days, they called it efficiency, engineer's time efficiency. He rearranged the whole assembly. He made arrangements like a post office with little boxes and merely by changing the method of sending them out. They used to go and grab a book out of the box and another book out of the box. A girl could stand there and pack an order of 25, 30 or whatever in seconds back quickly. Then the price went down to a nickel.
Because then he was working for the magazine and could get some back.
Well, this was my father. Actually, he was very brilliant and very productive and that sort of thing, but he was not the sort of person who knew how to take advantage of the situation. What he should have done, he was not involved with the Little Blue Books, he had no responsibility for them. His was the magazine, the paper. What he should have done, if he had been the sort of man who knew how to accumulate money, would see, say, Emmanuel, I know you can sell these for 10 cents, so maybe a nickel. And you'll make a contract if your costs go down and your profits go up. But no. The thing was the thing. I mean, the idea was first to accomplish something. Second, he was thoroughly in accordance with the idea of providing worthwhile literature at a price that people could afford to have.
The pamphlets that I've seen were all those ones printed by Charles Kerr in Chicago, all those little red ones.
The little blue books came out long before that. I was 14. Mm-hmm. 51 years ago. The Little Blue Books were not selling that many because, as I say, their method of handling was so expensive. But they had been in existence for several years, and he had only maybe 15. And during that 1 year, having found such a cheap way to handle them, and they added on many titles, I think the time came within a very short period where they were 150 or 200. So they would have advertisements in the paper and give all these titles and boxes, and they all had numbers, Little Blue Book number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. And they people just make the title and send a check in. But it was an interesting connection. Jane Addams' niece and Emmanuel Holden Julius, whose father was one of the great bookbinders in this country.
Were all these rich friends of your mother's, like the Kolicks and stuff, were they members of the Socialist Party, or were they just...
I don't know whether they were or not. Whether they were socialists or whether they were simple people who were interested in social reform.
So they might have been like social workers or reform types.
Reform types. I mean, you're typical club woman type who has money and who also has come in contact with talkers, you know, all its phases, and felt that the Socialist Party might be one way to exert pressure upon them, not to believe intrinsically in socialism.
Yeah.
Such.
But she wasn't hostile to people like that. There was
No, quite the contrary. And as a matter of fact, many of the people I knew who were very close associated with my mother, like Judith Mitchell, for example, Lillian Ball, Mrs. Sinkovich, I don't believe those people were associated.
No, I don't think they were either.
But nevertheless, there was a certain confraternity.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain objectives that they held in common. One of which was, of course, woman suffrage, child labor laws, and various and sundry other objectives that they had in common.
What did your mother work with them on? Because they were all in Chicago. What was her, like, what was a year in her life or a week in her life or something like? Would she be on the road all the time? Or what would she do?
She would be on the road for 2 or 3 months at a time.
And during that time, she would be in a different place every day? Essentially.
And during that time, she would be in sometimes a different place every day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, if she went to a large center like Chicago or New York, she might be here for as long as a week. And with this, a number of meetings, and also had various and sundry conferences with socialists and activists in all fields that she was interested in. And then she would make a wide sweep around in between, we'll say, New York and St. Louis. It would be many stops, some very small.
No, it'll be by train.
Oh, by train.
And she would stay with friends or stay at hotels?
Unless there happened to be a friend that she was particularly fond of. Because when you're lecturing, it's a very, it's more taxing, actually, than being in a theater.
Mm.
Because a lecturer is speaking for 2 solid hours.
That's a long lecture. People really like them that long?
And a smart lecturer. And this was, my mother was very good. She had a great sense of the pulse of the reaction.
Mm-hmm. She would just start telling jokes when people were
there. She would tell one, usually.
Mm-hmm.
She might even notice that, and say, hey, I noticed that there are a lot of coughs around here. You either have a lot of upper respiratory infections, or maybe you're bored with what I'm saying. And then this reminds me of the story. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is shock tactics.
Yeah.
But she did it very graciously, and she was just a very good job.
Mm-hmm. And was part of her job to be selling literature after the speech?
Afterward, no, she never sold the literature.
Mm.
There would be socialist literature at the entrance. Incidentally, they never charged admission there.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought they did sometimes to raise money for the chapter or something.
Oh, no. They never charged admission. They took up a collection.
Mm.
And people were... It was indicated to them they were welcome, whether they could contribute or not.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to, they did. And it was a question literally of passing the hat so that people could, you know, put their hand in, and it might be a nickel and dime, a quarter, a penny. Bills, it just depended entirely on their resources. And then at the entrance to the meeting, of course, there would always be the table, which had socialist literature, trade union literature, anything that she thought was, would be of interest to them.
Would she bring that with her, or would they have it there already?
Sometimes the chapters bring their own.
So she would have to lug a lot of literature with her?
She never did, them, they would be shipped.
Yes,
they would always be shipped. She might have had simple samples or something, but actually, the organization of the lectures would be, I would say, for example, I don't think this is the case, but I would say, for example, that the Sorrows of Jupiter, which was extremely popular, once that caught on, this being her own book and her own copyright, this would be shipped ahead and then sent to the meeting, and the committee would arrange that in the other literature. But they never charged admission to the lecture.
After the lecture, would there be questions and answers? How long would those go on?
As long as it was productive.
Were they gone for hours or half?
Well, I would say most questions and answers period would be limited at first by how searching and useful the questions were. And second, by whether she had to make a train for the night and how much time she had. But she stayed, as a rule, in hotels for a very good and cogent reason, and we're traveling in a taxi.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
It's much more useful to live with a hotel. And then it's the entertainment dinner by the committee.
Yeah.
This is one thing, but to be a house guest is
a different thing. Was she friendly with the other Socialist Party women speakers, like Lena Morrow Lewis and other people who would go around?
I'm sure she was. You see, her position in the Socialist Party was very much that of a kind of girl she could afford to be. Very nice to other speakers. I think the only people who were in her class, as far as active women, would be Jane Addams, Harry Chapman, Platt, people who had a tremendous following.
She had that kind of personal following.
But her own personal following was never in question. So she could certainly afford to be, and I'm sure was, very gracious. And there really wasn't a rival with her, because many people were extremely kind in their own field and achieve great things. They didn't happen to be terribly good public speakers.
I guess Elizabeth Gilbert Finn was, but she was more in a different organization,
Well, as a matter of fact, my mother and Elizabeth Gilbert Finn, as I remember it, were rather good friends. There was another one by the name of McHale.
McHale?
Who may have been a very small potato, I don't know, but mother was very fond of her. She was very up and coming.
Was she in St. Louis?
Who
else were her close friends in the movement? Debs, I suppose.
Oscar Ammerer. Who was out in Milwaukee. Among the men, mother really didn't have any close women friends. She actually never had an intimate woman friend that I know of. There were women that she saw that she liked and collaborated with and had nice social. But actually, as women do, usually at some time or other in their lives, have one or two or three really, really close friends that are like closest to blood.
And she didn't confide in anybody except you. It must have been hard for her.
I think she could get.
But it's a strange not to.
I think she could have. No, I don't think there was any of my mother. She probably confided in people from time to time. But basically, her friends were the men who knew, like Scott Nearing, Nelson Sinclair, Oscar Ammerer. She was extremely fond of. mm-hmm. a Tishner. Mm-hmm. You've seen the post, you know, Tishner's right.
Yeah.
And she was extremely fond of Tishner. And of course, she was extremely fond of the Vine, so was my father. Not the publisher of the poem, right now.
Mm-hmm.
He was an extremely nice person. And there was a nice social contact, a nice business contact.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of we dined there, they dined with us, but it was not an extremely intimate relationship.
Mm.
The most intimate relationship that my father had was first with Deb, I would say. He loved him very, very much, and they were very close. And then as a bishop, he was a socialist with Dr. Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And he and my father lived in St. Louis, and he and my father were great cronies.
Mm-hmm.
And their house was like our house.
Mm-hmm.
They were very wonderful people. And so my father had very intimate friendships with people. He really,
mm-hmm.
really cared about people without being close to them. Mother, not really.
Mm-hmm. Well, she had a different style of life too, I guess. Traveling all over, I think.
Oh, she. Make no mistake about it, she was very gregarious, she was very social, and she loved to entertain us. And there were people that she enjoyed being with.
Mm-hmm.